Could you first tell me, Mr. Geoffrey Moy, where and when you were born?
I was born in 1922 in London, Streatham.
What date was that in 1922?
March the 20th.
What were the names of your parents?
Robert Joseph Moy was my father, and my mother was Ella Muriel Moy.
And
I was going to say she died about 1942.
Mm. What was your father's occupation?
Oh, he was a stockjobber.
Were any of your other relatives?
Yes, I had an uncle who also ran a stock exchange firm, which was called Moy Davis Smith and Vanderfelt, country brokers.
So was it a member firm of the London Stock Exchange?
Yes, they were both member firms. My father became a member in 1909, and he started his own firm in 1919 called Robert Moy & Co. And he specialised in the rubber market, because round about that time, a lot of these Malaysian rubber companies came to the market, you see. There was a rubber boom in 1911, and after that they became extremely popular with the British public. And he started in the market, I suppose, around after the end of the last war, or the First World War. And he instigated bringing these rubber companies, these Malaysian rubber companies, to the British market. And he and a friend with Zorn and Lee Hunt, which were the main rubber dealers at that time, were more or less responsible for this move. And then that was in 1919. I joined the firm in 1947 after the war, and became a member in 1951.
Good. Let me go back a little bit. Do you have any recollection of who he was working for before he formed Robert Moy & Co.? Was it a job firm?
Yes, well, he joined my... I've got all these notes here because I've been taking them from the, from our genealogy point of view. Came a member in 1909, as I've said. In 1911, he joined a firm called P. Vanderfell, which lasted up to the commencement of the First World War.
And were they a jobbing firm?
No, I think they were brokers, actually. Mm. There were so many of the firms in those days. There were, as I expect you've probably seen these stock exchange books, there's about 400 or 500, all terribly small firms with about 2 members. Anyway, he joined P. Vanderfell. This was up to 1914, when he joined the army, and then he was associated with my uncle's firm, which was, as I said, Moy Davis. His name is Arthur Moy. And then, actually it was 1920 that he started his own firm, and he had about 2 partners, which became larger as time went on.
Do you have any recollection of what your grandparents had?
Well, my grandfather, although I've looked him up, he, in his history, it appears to have been on the stock exchange, but there's no mention of him in any of the members' books, so I would imagine that he must have just been associated with a firm. It might have been with my uncle's firm, because he died in 1937, and he gave the impression that back in 1888, when we were looking up some other details about the family history, that he was actually, he gave his profession as stock exchange. although he couldn't have been a member, actually.
And what about your other grandparent?
Well, my grandmother?
Yes.
I think she died. We haven't really gone into her details, actually. I don't really know very much about
her. Grandparents on your other side, you know what your grandfather had done on your...
Yes, he was an artist, actually. And he lived, I should think, from about 1830 to about 1900. My mother was born about 1890 and died in about 1940, so she was about 49, 50 when she died.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I've got two brothers, actually.
Yeah. And what had they done as careers?
Well, actually, my elder brother, he has been with BP for quite a long time, ever since about 1940. And he left BP about 1978 and joined an American oil company called Pace. And he retired last year. And my other brother, Trevor Moy, he's went out to Ceylon in 1950 and became a tea planter. And ultimately, he became chairman of the company, which was called George Stewart, and was responsible in about 1977 for bringing all the British tea companies under the jurisdiction of the Ceylonese government. You know, they were all nationalised, and he did it all, and he got an OBE for it. And since then, of course, the company didn't really have any business, so they had to branch out and find new ways of making money. And so they went into a whole variety of things, which weren't really particularly successful. But fortunately, they had quite a lot of property, so they were able to live off, you know, selling the property and things like that. He's retired now as well. He retired last year. And I think he's very glad to be away from Sri Lanka, as you can imagine.
Yes.
They've had a lot of trouble out there, and they're still having it.
Where had your parents sent you to school?
I went to Stowe.
Had the stock exchange impinged terribly much on your upbringing? Did you have much impression as a boy
what
your father did for a living?
Yes, I realised what he did for a living. We used to have the Financial Times at school. I used to make a kind of chart of the shares and things like that because I was interested. And I always felt I'd rather like to go into the stock exchange anyway. So that was a kind of start, anyway, to doing this.
Have you got any idea what attracted your father to deal in rubbish shares? Had there been some personal connection?
There's been a tremendous amount of publicity about rubbish shares, and tremendous turnover compared to other markets. And also, he was very friendly with his senior partner of Zorlan E. Hunt. And as he, I presume, was one of the main rubber jobbers, I mean rubber brokers, he might have, I'm only assuming this, he probably got my father interested in going into the market. I should think that's more than likely, really. So they had a good combination of a jobber and broker, you see.
Yes. Was this particular broker the shop to many of these rubber firms?
Oh, yes, they were the shop. And, of course, they brought them to a lot of these companies from about 1920 to about 1930, were brought to the market, you know, under his, you know, on... As the shop, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
And had the rubber market been able to provide your father with a decent living?
Oh, yes. He did very well indeed out of it. Up to 1940, of course. In 1940, the Japanese, or was it 41?
41,
I think. They walked into Malaysia. And, of course, all those rubber shares were worth absolutely nothing. They were kind of selling them in bulk in those days. So he lost a lot of money then. And I don't think he really properly recovered from that, because he was making a lot of money, say, from about 1930 to 39. And, you know, we all went to public schools and we all lived very well. And then, of course, the bubble broke, burst.
What do you think? What do you feel the attitude would have been among the boys at school or the masters to a city career during the time when you were at school or the stock exchange? For example, some people have said to me that the stock exchange was regarded as the place for the misfit in the family.
Yes, that's true. I don't think at school it was given very much thought, actually. And also, when you come to think of it, after going into the stock exchange, one realised that a lot of the people there were in their late 70s and 80s, and they just treated the place like a club. But there again, of course, you had to be pretty bright in order to make money. I would say you could, if you were a jobber, you had to be fairly bright. I mean, you couldn't just have somebody who couldn't do anything else taking over the responsibility of jobbing, because, you know, it was quite an acquired art. You had to, know when you did a good bargain and know when you did a bad bargain. It was a question of, something up there which, either waved a red flag or a green flag, so to speak.
Well, so, you mentioned that at school you had an idea that you'd like to have a stock exchange career. Was that a fairly fixed ambition, or did you have any other ideas?
I was thinking at the time that I might like to have been an architect, actually, because I was very keen on drawing and painting, and I probably inherited this from my grandfather on my mother's side. But of course then the war came along, and after being in the army for a time, there was no time after I left, when I was about 24, forwarding my career as an architect, so that's why I joined my father's firm.
How had the firm fared during the war? You mentioned that in 1940, 41, there was the bottom fell out of
the market.
Yes. Had your father been able to keep the firm ticking over?
Yes, because you see, in those days, the costs of running a firm were microscopic. Whereas today, the cost of running a firm is absolutely scandalous. You've got to make 2 or 3 million a week in order to run level, so to speak. But in those days, you had a small firm. In fact, I've got one or two balance sheets of my father's dating about 1946. And the outgoings of the firm, these were splits, telephone bills, electricity, things like that. It only cost about under $1,000 a year. I mean, it was nothing. And you could keep a firm going like that indefinitely. That is, providing you got a bit of capital behind you. But of course, you couldn't do anything like that now. So, there was no... He was obviously living off capital, because he lived in a fairly expensive sort of way. He liked clubs and things like that and so forth. And he was always very generous and so forth.
How would you describe the firm at the time you joined it in 1947, for example?
Well, it was a small firm. There were about four or five partners. It was, I think at that particular time, the end of the small firm, the very small firm, was beginning to obviously change. People in the 50s started looking at larger combinations. You know, the first firm to do this was Wed Durlacher. And so I thought, you know, that the possibility of being able to carry on alone, with especially after my father died, because he was at the time about 80, he was 80 in 1957, so he wasn't going to last very much longer, and of course the money that he left would have been divided between my brothers. So I was rather keen on joining up with a larger firm, which we did actually in about 1959, a firm called C.D. Clark.
Well, let me go back to when you first joined the firm. Was it still dealing exclusively in rubbish shares?
No. He was also very keen on certain industrial shares, which he was associated with. He either knew a director or he'd been asked to deal in them all. So there was a kind of mixed bag of industrial shares, which he used to deal in, things like Colite and one or two store shares and Crystalate, you know, it was a whole hodgepodge of things which had no real bearing on any type of market or anything like that. They were just things which he'd been asked to deal in, or he probably knew the director or the chairman. And of course it was a different, you see, these days, if that was, if he was dealing in those shares now, people would always say that he had insider knowledge or things like that about it, and it wouldn't really be, it would be rather frowned upon, I should think. So it wouldn't be thought well of anyway.
What were the first jobs they had you doing in the firm?
Delivering stock, I think, really. Going around the stock exchange, finding out where all the offices were, and then the ledgers, you know, putting in bargains in these big ledgers, sitting at an old-fashioned desk on a stool, that sort of uncomfortable feeling in an old-fashioned office, which as soon as we left was pulled down, actually, about 1960. It was Great Winchester Street. And so that's where were my first, you know, ideas, or my first impressions of the stock exchange. And then I went into the market in, I suppose it must have been about 49. Although my father was always trying to get me to take another job. I don't know whether he thought my capabilities of being a jobber were not all that good, but he was always sending me off on interviews to see whether I'd be interested in joining Splintex Glass or Triplex or something like that.
And what was your feeling about this? Were you happy?
I wasn't excited, but interested. And when I saw the chairman of Splintex, he said, "I don't know why you've come, you seem to have a very good job. Why didn't you continue on the stock exchange?" So I said, "Well, my father keeps on sending me off on these wild goose chases." So in the end, as you can see, I continued.
Now, you went into the market in 1949. Was that as a blue button?
Yes, as a blue button.
And what kind of things did one do as a blue button?
Well, you ran messages most of the time. You watched what was going on. You learnt the prices. Obviously, your job as a blue button besides delivering messages and learning the arts of dealing, one had to be able to remember all the prices, which is, of course, is very difficult these days because you have, you're not watching people deal. And, you know, in the evenings you help take out the profit and loss account and things like that. And
do you have any early recollections of going into the physical stock exchange itself? Any first impressions of...
Well, actually, the first time I went in was when I was in my teens, you know, at the invitation of my father. We just kind of walked round the floor. You were... You couldn't... nobody was actually allowed to go in, but you could get special permission to take your offsprings in if you so desired. And you see, there was... If a stranger, I expect you probably know this, or if a stranger came into the house, everybody would know. And they used to shout out 1400. You know that story. So you had to be extremely careful about getting permission and so forth. So. And that was my first memory of it. Although I don't think... at the age of about 14 or 15, one didn't really take in very much. It was a massive old building, very impressive. And they used to get up to lots and lots of games there, as you probably know, all fantastic games. That was what kept them going, I think, really, most of the time, because, you know, certain periods were extremely boring. And there were days when there was no business. And I remember when I joined in the early 50s, that sometimes we only did about 5 or 6 bargains a day, which is hardly enough to kind of keep a firm going. And the general number of marks were probably about 5,000 in the stock exchange, whereas the average number these days is about 30,000.
How would you occupy yourself on a day in which there were only 5 bargains?
Well, of course, you did have a lot of people around you. And I suppose, really, it was more social than anything else. One was always looking for business. One was always going through one's books, trying to find something which you could make money out of. It wasn't just a question of sitting there waiting for the next person to come round. I'm saying the same sort of principle works now, that you've got to look for business. You can't expect it to come to you the whole time. You go round to brokers and try and get them interested in a line of shares or something like that. It's quite hard work to do this and to give a reason why you feel that they should be interested in buying them. Mm. So that takes up a certain amount of time, then you've always got people coming round asking prices, showing an interest in the market. And after all, I think one of the main things in those days was to have a good relationship with brokers, to know them well, so that you could create some sort of business. Mm-hmm. These days, that doesn't seem to be quite so important because everything's done by phone. Mm-hmm.
So would there be particular broking firms or particular brokers that your firm would have had a long association with?
Yes, people who specialised in the rubber market. And then, of course, people... My father used to deal, as I've said, in these industrial shares. One obviously knew which brokers were interested in which shares. And, you know... one of the first things one would have to know was who is the broker to the company, who's the shop. And obviously they would be the first person to be interested if there was a line of shares on offer or being bid for. Mm. Mm.
When did you actually become a dealer, authorised?
Well, that must have been about 1950.
What was the Robert Moy pitch like? For example, you mentioned that you were dealing in a mixture of industrial as well as the rubber stocks. Did you have a separate industrial pitch somewhere?
No, it was all in one, actually. It was the way the floor was managed in those days was that you did actually have about six jobbers which made up the rubber market. And they were all around us. And also, to the right, there was the beginning of the industrial market, so it was quite convenient that my father's shares were on the outskirts of the industrial market, and the rubber shares were on the outskirts of the rubber market, so to speak. So it didn't really make any difference. It was a good position. It was a bench, an old-fashioned bench, which one kind of put one's board up against with one's prices displayed on it. And eventually, I think there were only about three firms in the rubber market, you know, because in the 50s there was absolutely no business at all. So people just slowly disappeared.
Can you remember which the main firms had been?
Yes, there was Shrewsbury Brothers. They were probably the biggest. And Pynchon, which, as you know, were taken over by Morgan Grenfell. Dickinson and Duncombe was a firm which was taken over by Smith Brothers. Frisby, I joined Frisby actually after C.D. Clark packed up, but that's I'll come to later. And let's see, there was a very tiny firm, two people called Breyer and Co. And another one, reasonable size, called Denny, which joined up with Pynchon. At a later date.
Did you have firms that have been described to me as the book and pencil jobbers or the spoon-fed jobbers in the sense that they were very small and they would basically come and undo their business with the larger jobbers?
That's right, they did do that. If there was a boom in the market, in the rubber market, for example, certain jobbers would take up the first line shares and make a book in them, and then at the end of the day they would come and undo their position with the actual permanent members of the market, because obviously they didn't want to run a position overnight.
Was that something that happened in your experience?
Oh yes, it did. It happened in the 50s. There were one or two small firms who did do this. After all, there was so much business going on in those days, and there were orderly queues of brokers waiting to deal with you. You know, if there was boom conditions, not like it is now, where people used to rush around you. There, in those days, in 1952, they used to queue up to deal with you. And after waiting about 20 minutes in a queue and they finally got to you and they said, "What a sangue ghetto," or something like that, and you said, "I'm sorry, I don't deal." Oh. In fact, they went through the roof, so I had to start a queue somewhere else. But it was a long, rather lengthy process, as you can imagine. And, the thing about it, of course, too, was that if you were standing in a queue and there were four other jobbers dealing in the stock, you would find that all four jobbers were making a completely different price to what you were. There was no means of knowing what your opposition was making. I would say they might have been making 2 and 3 6, and you might have been making 2 and 9 3 shillings. And you were dealing on that basis, and they were dealing on the 2 and 3 6 basis. So, you know, that's how life was in those days. Mm. And obviously, the next day, there was a lot of hard talking about the prices which clients were getting for their shares or paying for their shares.
Do you ever have recollections of particular experiences?
Well, yes, it often happened. It's not surprising, really.
And would the broker then come up to you and complain that you would...
He would come up and say, well, look, I've been having a look at them, the marks, and they range between, say, 2 and 3 and 3 shillings, you see. And I pay 3 shillings, and the lowest mark is 2 and 3. What have you got to say about it? Well, there wasn't very much that you could say about it. You weren't obviously doing him, but as I explained, that's how it materialised, you see, really.
Did you ever have any way of knowing what the other jobbers were quoting?
No, you didn't. There was no, there was no way of telling at all, unless you looked at their boards. The boards were supposed to be kept up to date. You know, they were ordinary thing, like about half the size of this table, with the stock on the left-hand column, and the starting price, which was maybe £1, and then as the shares went up, you used to change the price, you see. But there again, in those days, the art of jobbing was trying to prevent anybody else knowing what you were doing. Today,